Hello, everybody. It's Monday. It's 1 o'clock, and we are back. Oh, hold on. Try that again. Hi, everybody. We are back. It is Monday. It's 1 o'clock in Israel, and it's time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. One of the things that I've been mentioning ever since I started this series is that the reason why history is in the title of the talk is because of the fact that I use history for in two ways to be able to elucidate tractate Avot, Pirkei Avot. One is to simply discuss the historical background and impact of as many of the statements of the rabbis as are relevant. At the same time, and I think the part of it that got me going doing this kind of interpretation, and frankly, I've been doing this, interpreting Pirkei Avot in this way, easily, oh my God, almost 40 years, about 35, 36 years. I started when I was a rabbi in Riverdale, New York. And that is to take the words of Pirkei Avot and to examine not so much what they mean per se against the original background in which they were said, but to examine the way that they were understood in different communities by different thinkers at different times in history, with the idea that the interpreters bring to the understanding of words their own personal experience and concerns. Now, the reason why I mention this is because, as it happens, the next Mishnah that we are about to do, we're coming close to the end of the second chapter, which is pretty amazing, actually is, in my opinion, or from my experience, the emblematic example of what I mean. So let's get cracking. The Mishnah is the 14th Mishnah of the second chapter of Pirkei Avot, and it reads as follows. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Elazar, I assume Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, said, we used to say, Heve shoked or shakud. Every word here is going to be very important. Be diligent or be eager, lilmod Torah, to study Torah. Get your moxie up. Be enthusiastic, and initiate Torah study. We'll come back to that. Vida masha tashiv la bikaris, and know what to respond, or how to debate. An apikoros, we're not going to say what that means yet, because that's going to be part of the deal here. Now, the truth of the matter is that there are differences of opinion, or there are different versions of this Mishnah, as to whether the word vida and no has a conjunction or not. In other words, does it have a vav there or not, which would mean, and it's a very big difference. In other words, is Rabbi Elazar saying you should be eager to study Torah in order to be able to reply to an apikoros, whoever that is? Or are they two separate statements? And that's going to make a very big difference. Mishnah is going to take, it was one of these, it's going to take us a few weeks to do Mishnah Yod. And then, Veda, and not only that, you should know, Lifnei Miata Amel, know before whom you toil, meaning obviously God, V'ne'eman hu bal malachtecha, and the person who has hired you, the person who's in charge of your profession or of your efforts, is reliable. She shalem lach or shalishalem lacha, he will pay you sechar peulatcha, the reward for your efforts. So there's a lot here. We have to. I don't know if I like that expression, but there's a lot here to unpack. I'm actually going to do things a little bit differently today. I'm not going to talk about the first part about what does it mean lishkod lilmod Torah. We'll do that maybe next week. And I'm not going to talk about whether there's a connection between the study of Torah and reply to the Apikoros or not. That'll also be for next week. In the meantime, I want to hone in on the word Apikoros. The statement that Rabbi Lezer makes is, know what to reply to an Apikoros. Now in ancient and medieval Hebrew, the word lehashiv, to reply, it's not a neutral word. It's not today. For example, if those of us who live in Israel, we use Twitter, we use email, we use all kinds of things. And if somebody sends you an email, then the translation of the word send is hashev, respond. Okay, tshuva means an answer. And again, there is no. It's a pretty neutral world. Somebody asks you a question, give an answer. Somebody sends you a letter, you give a response. It's not a loaded word. However, up until, even to this day, I should say, in the in rabbinic literature, and certainly in medieval literature, the word tshuva has a polemical nuance to it. In other words, if I am meshiv, it means that I debate. And if I debate, and sometimes it even has a very provocative element to it. In other words, if somebody is meshiv alai, if somebody responds to me, it means that they are calling into question something that I said, or they are demanding an answer on a topical or on a controversial topic. So, for example, the Gemara said, the Talmud says in Tractate Yoma, and this is quoted in a lot of different places in the Middle Ages, that Chazal said, this is a Yoma 60b, the Gemara says, points out, and it's a distinction which is quite common and pretty well known, that there is a fundamental distinction between two types of mitzvot. There is a mitzvah known as a mishpat, and there's a mitzvah known as a chok. A mishpat is a law which is fairly straightforward. No reason why not to understand it. It's very clear why the Torah advocated or prohibited something. So, for example, it likes to quote examples like the prohibition against stealing, and the prohibition against murder, or on the more positive end, honoring your parents. Every civilization that's worth its salt has these things, and it's their value and their logic and their rationality is self-evident. Those are mishpatim. It's quintessentially accessible and understandable and rational. Chukim is another story. What's a chok? A chok is it's usually translated ordinance. I never understood why that is. It's an order. God just commands it, as it were. That's things like not eating pork. It's interesting. The examples changed throughout the Middle Ages, but Chazal mentioned not eating pork and not wearing clothing that contains both wool and linen, or the mystery of the Seir HaMishtaleach, of the scapegoat on Yom Kippur, or, and of course, the ultimate chok, the ultimate mystery, the ultimate mysterious mitzvah is, of course, the red heifer, which defiles the pure and purifies the defiled, and so on and so forth. Okay. That statement of Chazal in Tractate Yoma, which, as I said, pops up all throughout the Middle Ages, Rashi quotes it at least once, I think actually twice, is that these are things, says Rashi, that people have trouble with chukim, the things that are seemingly not so rational and not accessible, not understandable, are things that bother one's it raises doubts, it troubles you, it's not why you end up with no decent answer to why these things were commanded and why they are the way they are. And among the another characterization that Chazal say is the umot ha'olam mishivin aleihem, the nations of the world reply about them. Well, that doesn't make any sense. No, it doesn't mean reply. It means debate. It means that they provocatively ask, what kind of crazy, seemingly crazy thing is this? And we are required to respond. Teshuvah is a polemical or a debate, not debatable, but a polemical or a an argumentative response to the claim of the other side. So Rashi, for example, and Rashbam and Ibn and Yosef Ekara, especially in the in France in the 12th century, but throughout the ages, you find in many commentaries on the Bible, especially, that this is the answer. This is this interpretation. The interpreter is given tshuvat haminim, to respond in a debating kind of mode to the claims, to the provocative attacks or criticisms of the outside world. A lot of, I mean, inevitably, for example, anti-Christian or responses to Christian claims about the Bible will be framed as tshuvat haminim. We are hereby responding, but not but in a very loaded sense, to the claims or to the assertions of Christians. Like, for example, I mean, a famous one, in the first verse in the Bible, it says, "Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz." So the from the second century already, at least, the Christian interpreters of the Bible like to say, "See, God is the word Elokim." That's interesting. How am I quoting it here? Let's be safe. Elokim is in plural, and that shows God can be plural, and therefore you can have a Trinity. And then we respond, Shuvat Haminim. The answer that we give to their outrageous claim is that no, in this case, as you take a look at the verb, I mean, Breshis Bara Elokim Eit Bara. It's a singular form, so you see the Elokim is singular. So when Dama Shatashiv Lapikaritz doesn't mean just gives it a quiet answer like sending an email back. It means no. When you are engaged in a debate with an Apikaritz, know how to reply, know how to debate. Now that's by itself a very loaded and a very repercussive, as Tversky would say, term. Because to be able to respond, and I hope to talk about this a little bit later, maybe not today, next week, to be able to respond means that you have to have the tools to be able to, A, understand the bases of the argument made against you. You have to understand the language, literally and also in terms of content, that the claims are put against you. And you have to be able to reply in a coin, in a language and in terms and in a fashion which will commit, which will be both understood and will command at least the understanding, if not the assent. Maybe you'll get lucky, right? Maybe you'll get lucky and you'll be able to convince the person or refute the person that they can understand. If you speak in different languages and are coming from different places, you're not going to get anywhere. You're just going to create a dialogue of the deaf. Now, that's a problem. Again, it's not for now. In terms of the way that many, at least Orthodox Jewish leaders and people, especially social media, get into trouble because they don't understand the language or the terms or the philosophy or the fundamental assumptions of contemporary, especially progressive, but not only, liberal society, and therefore can't respond in terms. So they either end up looking helpless or hopeless or sometimes stupid. So damish etashiv means know how to debate and know how to respond, and know what the proper response to provocative questions is, in a way that your audience is usually more important, and your interlocutor will in fact be able to understand, at least understand what you're getting at. Okay, so dama shetashiv laapikaris. Here we come to this point with which I started the discussion today. Who's an apikaris? What's an apikaris? Apikaris is a word in contemporary, it's not really used that often, and yet it's overused. An apikaris is usually the word, when it's used, it's usually bandied about something like heretic or a person who leans towards heresy. And today, in general, the heresy is not a not a popular word. Anyways, whether it exists or not is another story. But it's not a clearly, carefully defined term. In the past, it has been. So let's get back. Let's go back to history. In the second, let the Elizabeth and Azariah lived in the second century CE. What was going on? Who was an Apikoros? So clearly, there's no question that an Apikoros is an Epicurean. Now, what's an Epicurean? Now, most people know Epicure. Oh, that's a guy who's a, in Hebrew, you say a feinschmecker. That's a person who likes his food, and he likes, he's very, very, he's got very, very highly developed tastes for food and for clothing and for all kinds of for all kinds of things. Epicure is a gourmand, you know, a guy who knows, you know, he'll spend $3 million to buy a truffle. But that's not the word. That's really only a very, like a tertiary meaning of the word. What's an Epicurus? So Epicurus was a Greek philosopher who was actually the leading, a leading student of the Greek philosopher, the pre-Socratic, Democritus. Who was Democritus? Democritus was the first atomist. Democritus taught that the world is composed of atoms. And atoms that sort of random, it sounds familiar, huh? He was the first atomist. Atoms that sort of float around in the world, and they go crashing into each other and become all kinds of stuff. Sometimes they become lamps. I'm looking at my desk is the reason I'm coming up with this. Sometimes they come up as lamps. Sometimes they come up as people. Sometimes come up as a lizard. And other times they come up as a stone. And then at a certain point, especially when things die, the atoms are released and they go and become something else. And there's really no rhyme or reason why, you know, the same atom shouldn't make an animal or make a desk or make a phone. It's all very happenstance. There is no providence. It's all very, very much chance, a chance business. Now, Democritus did not know about electromagnetic fields and all kinds of other things. But this was, and but so as a result, this is what he came to. Now, once you come to that conclusion that there are no gods and everything sort of happens, so there are very serious philosophical and especially moral implications of that theory, which were developed by him, but more importantly by Epicurus. Epicurus said, wait a minute, if that's the way the world is structured, and there is no supreme power that guides things, and everything is, I mean, for the same difference, I could have been born a lamp, or I could have been born a computer, so let din veled dayan. There is no justice. There are no there are no binding eternal moral anythings or rules, and nobody's going to judge me because, you know, for the same difference, when I die, my atoms will be liberated, and I'll go. You know, maybe I will become a desk, or maybe I will become a bottle of soda. Who knows? As a result, so the end result of that was that since that's it, then we might as well enjoy ourselves while we're here, because that's it. So eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we become a computer. That, and as so from there you get the idea of, well, eat, drink, and be merry, you might as well enjoy yourself. You might enjoy, you know, so if you were born not a computer or not a bottle of soda or, you know, not a rock, but you were born a person, so you might as well maximize the pleasure that you have, and therefore you should become a gourmand, and you should understand, you know, food and enjoy yourself, you know, culinarily and sexually, whatever the case might be. Now, obviously, this position is the absolute opposite of Judaism. We believe that there was a God outside of who created time, who created the universe, upon whose existence we are all totally and inexorably dependent, and we do paper. We are responsible for our actions, and there is a law, there are rules that bind us. Sometimes they're comfortable, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're absolutely incomprehensible to us, but we are ultimately dependent on God's rules. And therefore, yesh din v'yesh dayan. There is a law to which we're all subjected, and to which we all are subservient. What exactly the laws are, that's a question. You know, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish, but that's not for now, not either. But the principle remains the same. So there is a moral law which is enforced upon people, and for which people have to, you know, are responsible for, you know, they have to make accounts for what they do. So Epicureanism is the absolute opposite of Torah. As it happens, and it's not really surprising, Epicureanism in its very forms, and I really made it very, have really dumbed it down. It's a very sophisticated philosophy, and how they work on how can society not turn into total anarchy if you're an Epicurean. All of that is nice, but not for now. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Just in general, by the way, my experience has been consistently that the less Wikipedia is a valuable beginning tool, and that its value becomes greater the more that the topic is not controversial. In other words, controversial topics, Wikipedia is absolutely worthless. However, on something that's you know, purely academic, it's a beginning. In any event, you can look up Epicurus, Epicureanism, Democritus, and have a good time. In any event, so apparently, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was tremendously concerned with the threat of Epicureanism and its attractions to Jews in second century Eretz Israel. And they had apparently very sophisticated arguments against the idea of creation of the world, against the of God, and so on, and you should know. It says Rabbi Elazar, you should know how to respond, because these guys are aggressive. And in general, you know, even if they weren't missionizing, okay, which I have no way of knowing if they were or not. I personally, I'm not a second century historian, I know what I read. The truth of the matter is, if you're not going to talk about the weather, and you don't have sports to talk about, and politics doesn't really change that much, and you're not in social media, when you meet somebody who's intelligent, what are you going to talk about? You talk about, I mean, up until relatively recently, and when if it's something to talk about during the crop, about the crops, then you talk about religion, and you talk about philosophy, and you talk about, you know, deep thoughts. And so these kinds of encounters between rabbis, especially, and non-Jewish or Jewish philosophers who were Epicureans were not that rare. Interestingly, I you know, that's as far as I knew, as far as I took it, and I never thought about it more than that. But sometimes, you know, things happen that that change the way you look at things, or at least they bring things home in a more powerful fashion. I was in the late '80s. I was back at Harvard for a week or so to turn in a chapter of my doctoral dissertation to the late Professor Twersky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And as it was all of our wants, I went back to the Widener Memorial Library, the greatest resource for scholarship that exists in the world, even in the world of the internet. And I was on the fabled sixth floor, which is where Jewish studies, among other things, where Jewish studies. Where the Jewish Studies collection was until relatively recently. Now it's big enough, it's been divided between the fifth and the sixth floor. And I was walking through the always half-dark stacks, and I noticed on a chair in a stall, was a book, Epicureanism in Roman Palestine. Whoa, I have to see this. So I open up, and it turns out it was a book published by Brill Publishing, which means it didn't get that much. My book is also published by Brill, so I know what this is about. So I know this is a book that was not very well known. I open it up, I start reading it, and it turns out that in fact, in the second century, in Eretz Israel, especially among non-Jewish intellectuals, there was a resurgence of Epicureanism. That became like the hot thing. something like woke or progressivism or Marxism at an earlier time, whatever the case might be. And everybody who was anybody in the intellectual world of Eretz Yisrael in the second century was an Epicurean. So that when Rebbe Lazar says, this was a very major issue, because these guys were really teaching all this stuff, and it was really undermining Jewish faith. Now, this is in the era after the temple's destroyed, before the authority of the rabbis is fully established, and it was a very serious intellectual challenge that had to be met, and that's what he's saying. Okay. So I'm convinced that not just apparently. That's the simple meaning of the verse. But what's interesting is what happens afterwards. I see it's 125. So I guess I'm going to complete this later, but I'll add one. I'll give you one example of where we're going to go with this. One of the victims of the decline of the Roman Empire was the decline of Greek philosophy, and especially as a result of Jews settling in all kinds of different places and the rise of Christianity and other considerations. The word apikoros really didn't mean anything anymore. And the Talmud, in fact, interprets the word apikoros from the word afkeruta, or from a generic of that. Afkeruta means to rebel. Lafkir really means to sort of like declare something ownerless. But in this case, it means afkeruta means to sort of throw off from oneself the authority of the Torah and authority of the sages. And it really begins to mean heretic, and it means an aggressive heretic. So it's interesting, whereas the apikoros in the original Mishnah most likely referred to a non-Jewish representative of an outside philosophy, it became internalized and referred to Jews who are involved in, who represent either a rejection of rabbinic Judaism, a rejection of the oral law, a rejection of normative rabbinic Judaism. Don't forget that all the other sectarians sort of disappeared after the destruction of the temple, or went underground, or actually people that had become infected or convinced of the truth of alien philosophies, which were antithetical to even within the broad range of what normative Judaism allows. So what could these things be? So it's very interesting in that regard. I was looking at the commentaries that are included in the Bar Ilan Project Ashut on this Mishnah. Absolutely striking, is the comment attributed. It's not by Rashi. The commentary on Avot that is attributed to Rashi is not by Rashi, but it comes out of the same kind of ambiance. It's either from his Beit Midrash or it comes out of his world, and that Mishnah and that commentary says nothing. It's amazing, and usually has very interesting things to say. The commentary by Rashi says, first, there's a statement you should study Torah, and then you should know what to respond, and then you should know that you work before God, and the only comment is Harei Shlosha. So there are three separate statements. Why is that of any significance? Because he noticed that the fact that so many of the other Mishnayot were divided into three separate statements, starting with the first Mishnah. The members of the Great Assembly said three things. So here you have three again. That's it. So if all that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said here was study Torah and know that you work before God, so I would have said fine. I would have said, okay, it's self-explanatory. It's self-evident. So goodbye. Finished. Nothing to say. I mean, on other occasions, regarding other Mishnayot, which makes similar points, the anonymous commentator says, all kinds of wonderful things about why you should study Torah, which is fine. But no comment about apikoros? Nothing? Now, you're not supposed to usually, I mean, it's not good form, to interpret silence. An argument from silence that there's no comment is usually like the weakest, it's usually the weakest form of argument, both in terms of halacha and in logic and certainly in scholarship. But we know a little bit about the world. We know a little bit about the world where this commentary came out of, which this commentary came. And I wonder, I can't prove it, but I wonder if the reason that the there's no comment on the need to respond to the Apicurus is because in the late 11th century and 12th century in France and in Germany, there really wasn't a problem of heresy among the Jews. If there was an intellectual challenge, it came from the church. But the church, remember, the word, because of the way that the Talmud uses the word Apicurus, understands it as a Jewish heretic or as a Jewish person who is being provocative and problematic. You know, it's no longer an outside threat. Outside threats plenty, but not here. So it might very well be that the silence of Rashi is because the Mishnah didn't resonate. When it really wasn't, there weren't any challenges to talk about. So you just quote the Mishnah and goodbye. As we shall see, however, now I can see where we're going to go next week, in other places, such as southern France, such as Spain, such as Egypt, there were very serious challenges coming from Jews. They were different. And every single one of them was denoted, termed to be, or identified with the Apicurus here. And this continues in the 15th century in Italy, and this becomes something in the 16th century in Prague, and then the 19th century in Germany. It's the same words, they are the same words, but very, very different challenges. And we will, it'll be to an examination of the nature of those, the nature of those challenges that we will give our attention in our next share. So thank you very much for joining us. Please feel free to share this, and we will see you next week. Bye.